Greetings, everyone. Welcome to the Law Hour Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally on KU Band Radio at Telstar 5, 7 days a week on Truth Radio Network, and in more than 70 countries worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit my webpage. That's georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Remember, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law news and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on modern money mechanics. The creation of the Federal Reserve System in 1913 did not render Federal Reserve notes politically independent or politically neutral, but merely changed the political character of the monetary system by empowering a small, unelected clique of self-professed experts and self-interested bankers and politicians to control the supply of Federal Reserve notes, interest rates, and other monetary and banking phenomena. Thus, as contrasted with the constitutional system, the Federal Reserve System actually politicized money by enabling politicians, administrators, and a few selected special interest groups to exercise the very influence over this country's monetary and banking systems that the Constitution had originally prohibited. Americans tend to accept the description of the Federal Reserve System as politically independent because, although control of the monetary and banking systems has serious political significance, the apologists for the Federal Reserve have been very successful over the years in removing monetary and banking issues from the agenda of political parties and political candidates and stifling public discussion of those issues. And yet, it is of vital political importance that no major political movement now advocates the immediate restoration of America's constitutional monetary system of silver and gold coin. It is of vital political importance that no major political movement demands that all of the paper currencies of the private banks be true fiduciary monies, that is, be redeemable in silver or gold or some other commodity with intrinsic value. It is of vital political importance that no major political movement attacks inherently fraudulent fractional reserve banking. And it is of vital political importance that no major political movement denounces the incestuous and corrupt relationship between the national government and the banking industry through the Federal Reserve System, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, and on it goes. It is of vital political importance that no major political movement challenges the government's use of the monetary and banking systems to regulate the economy and to impose pervasive police state surveillance on all Americans. And it is of vital political significance that the short-run effects of the Federal Reserve System's monetary and banking policies are very unclear to the average American, and that identifying, in the long run, who gains and who loses, what is gained and what is lost, and why all of this happens is also very difficult even for economists and political scientists. And it is of vital political significance that members of Congress apparently lack incentives or actually labor under disincentives to investigate, let alone to correct, this misguided and harmful policy of the Federal Reserve. And finally, it is of vital political importance that the general public is simply unable to devise effective strategies for dealing with the Federal Reserve System as a supposed agency of our government. Obviously, a group that could completely excise these matters from political discourse in the United States without complaint by any significant part of the public must be a very powerful group indeed. Now, how the apologists for the Federal Reserve have been successful since 1913 in stifling political debate on money and banking, the history books do not satisfactorily explain. What is clear enough, nonetheless, is that the Federal Reserve was established to remove the Constitution as the arbiter of national monetary policy on behalf of all Americans, and to guarantee instead that certain special interest groups are disproportionately, indeed monopolistically, represented in the determination of that policy for the peculiar benefit of those groups and at everyone else's expense. Here, then, more than one level of analysis is pertinent. So, first of all, at the first level, the Federal Reserve System appears as primarily a mechanism to stabilize an inherently, or the inherently, fraudulent fractional reserve banking system. And from this perspective, the purpose of the Federal Reserve System is not necessarily to do what the bankers want, but always to do what they need. Consider the devolution of the monetary system from a regime of commodity money to one of fiat money. Under a regime of commodity money, the bankers employ the inherently fraudulent fractional reserve system to expand the supply of fiduciary money, that is, banknotes and deposit currency, beyond the supply of commodity money, that is, gold and silver coin, available for redemption. And this then has two effects. First of all, the bankers can loan more money than otherwise, thereby increasing their profits. And number two, the holders of the fiduciary money become unknowing and presumably unwilling partners with the bankers in these excessive loans, thereby spreading the risk of those loans throughout society and indirectly insuring the bankers at the expense of the general public. Because the expansion of the supply of this inherently fraudulent fiduciary money is limited by the possibility of widespread demands for redemption, the so-called bank runs, followed by bankruptcy of the issuing banks. The bankers as a class support a series of steps designed to insulate the fractional reserve scheme from collapse. They do this, first of all, they use every available means of propaganda. They use agitation. They use disinformation to instill unjustified confidence in the holders of fiduciary money so as to minimize redemption and thereby facilitate ever greater expansion of the supply of the money. Underfunded deposit insurance schemes, either public or private, typify this deceptive tactic. Second, if bank runs do occur, the bankers importune the government to authorize suspensions of specie payments, temporary refusals on the part of the issuers of the fiduciary money to redeem their notes with commodity money. This permits the bankers to remain in business even though they are bankrupt. Suspensions of specie payments are a key indicator of the breakdown of the free market economy because they are a governmentally protected repudiation of contracts, in effect, governmentally licensed theft. Third, to prevent bank runs altogether, the bankers lobby for governmental permission to repudiate their fiduciary money supply totally and permanently, that is, to transform their fiduciary money into fiat money. This generally requires that the government activate some mechanism for the forced circulation of this fiat money, such as by making that money the unit for payment of taxes and for public expenditures, by declaring that money legal tender for all debts, or by outlawing contracts payable in any other form of money, especially commodity money. These steps substitute the government, actually the taxpayers, for the banks and their shareholders as the ultimate guarantors of this fiat money, in return for which the banks agree to two requirements. One is that they monetize the public debt, in effect enabling the government to use this fiat money system as an instrument of taxation. And then two, they cooperate in a cartel or other self-regulatory scheme to control their expansion of the supply of this fiat currency within limits that maintain public confidence and in the banking system and the government in general. In short, the government and the banks agree to divide the amount that can be looted from the general public by the manipulation of the money supply and to moderate that looting so that the public never catches on to how this theft actually works. Now, the Federal Reserve is simply an elaborate device set up to accomplish these very simple ends in a very highly convoluted and thereby deceptive way. The Federal Reserve was the response of bankers and their political cronies to decades of failures in the fractional reserve banking system at the local and regional levels throughout the United States between 1787 and about 1900. The Federal Reserve system was an attempt to maintain that system in perpetuity, first at the national level with the Federal Reserve Act in 1913, and then at the international level with the Bretton Woods Agreement in 1944. It was, or was, is the appropriate verb because the Bretton Woods Agreement collapsed in 1971 with President Nixon's repudiation of redemption of Federal Reserve notes in gold internationally, and mounting strains in the system have been appearing domestically since the 1970s. The key dates in the devolution of the Federal Reserve System are as follows. 1913, Congress created the Federal Reserve System and permitted the emission of FRNs, or Federal Reserve Notes, redeemable in lawful money, and declares Federal Reserve Notes to be obligations of the United States, but not legal tender. In practice, the Federal Reserve Banks and the United States Treasury redeem Federal Reserve Notes for gold coin on demand. Federal Reserve Notes are a fiduciary currency. In 1933, Congress repudiates redemption of Federal Reserve notes in gold for United States citizens and declares that Federal Reserve notes shall be legal tender. The government continues to redeem Federal Reserve notes in gold for foreigners, and United States citizens can redeem Federal Reserve notes for lawful money, such as United States Treasury notes and silver certificates, which is redeemable in silver coins. Therefore, Federal Reserve notes remain a fiduciary currency redeemable directly in gold internationally and indirectly in silver domestically. 1968, Congress repudiates redemption of all forms of lawful money and silver, thus returning or turning Federal Reserve notes into a fiat currency domestically for the first time. In 1971, President Richard Nixon repudiates redemption of ferns in gold, thus turning FRNs into a fiat currency internationally for the very first time. So today, Americans suffer under a regime of fiat money and unlimited fractional reserve banking. In this system, the Federal Reserve plays a very simple but vital role. When public confidence in the monetary and banking systems weakens, the Federal Reserve acts to restore confidence. The Federal Reserve may use what the public considers drastic means in this alleged fight, but never means so drastic that they precipitate the genuine economic collapse or seriously endanger the long-term interests of the banking cartel, its satellite industries, and its political cronies. Now, the unavoidable problem, of course, is that any system of fractional reserve banking suffers from inherent instability that increases over time because at base fractional reserve banking is a kind of Ponzi or a pyramid scheme. And it's for that reason that fractional reserve banking is a confidence game in both senses of that term. The Federal Reserve System, the banking cartel, and the politicians of the American one-party system operate on the theory that you can fool all of the people some of the time and some of the people all of the time, and that's good enough. But they forget that, as Lincoln concluded, you can't fool all of the people all of the time. So over time, some people, often large numbers of these people, do learn. And when they learn, the people who have learned tend to act on their knowledge. So the remaining lifetime of the Federal Reserve System confidence game may and likely will be relatively short. Now, on a higher level of analysis, the Federal Reserve System is not simply a control mechanism for the national banking cartel, but also one of the most important mechanisms in a pervasive system of economic regulation, and has been set up in this country slowly but surely since the turn of the century. And this explains the political independence of the Federal Reserve System in a way more logical than the idea that money and banking are no longer politically important, divisive, or even interesting subjects. Well, in a police state, in a fascist police state, if it is to regulate the economy with relative autonomy from the electoral public and most special interest groups, then its monetary agency must be able to claim political independence. Actually, in a fascist state, all of the regulatory agencies must claim political independence to some degree, which claim, not surprisingly, is advanced by essentially every administrative agency of the national government today. But the degree of political independence will vary with the importance of the agency to the overall scheme of centralized regulation of society. So the political independence the Federal Reserve claims is precisely expectable were it a part of an anti-democratic mechanism of economic and political control, and that no constitutional branch of the national government, not the Congress, not the President, not the judiciary, disputes the Federal Reserve's supposed independence, proves that those branches too have been co-opted as agencies of the fascist welfare state. So in sum, contemporary political money and the politicized banking system that generates it have five major consequences come from this fiat currency. First, modern political money is the prime means by which the government operates a scheme of oppressive hidden taxation through increases in the supply of money that generate systematic increases in the prices of goods and services. It's what the public calls inflation. Second, by operating as a system of hidden taxation, modern political money licenses the dominant financial and political oligarchy of this country to redistribute the nation's wealth from one group to another. More than $6 trillion has been thus redistributed since World War II. Now, that's according to the American Institute for Economic Research. And third, by functioning as a mechanism for redistribution of wealth, the modern political money system systematically corrupts the electoral process, enabling politicians to buy votes with promises of new or expanded governmental spending programs made possible only by the banking system's ability to monetize the public debt. And fourth, by linking the banking system to the public debt, modern political money licenses the banks to loot the public treasury. Initially, they do this by guaranteeing Federal Reserve notes as obligations of the United States, and specially privileging those notes as legal tender, and ultimately by providing taxpayer-funded bailouts of the bankers when the scheme of inherently fraudulent fractional reserve banking collapses. And then fifth and last, modern political money and political banking function as key mechanisms in the scheme of fascist central economic planning that misdirects and wastes resources and thereby lowers the standard of living of the vast mass of Americans for the benefit of a privileged few. Now, although long a powerful and today still a politically untouchable institution, the Federal Reserve System faces a dismal future. This can be assessed by considering the contemporary political economic conditions that have given rise to the problem of collapsing domestic banks. The first of these conditions is the essentially fictional and fraudulent nature of modern paper money and fractional reserve banking. The fractional and fraudulent character of contemporary paper money is a determinant additional to the inescapable economic disparity between all paper money and real money, that is, silver and gold coins. Paper money can never be economically equivalent to real money because a transfer of real money between two persons immediately transfers a real asset, the gold and silver, that comprises the coin. Unlike real money, which is itself the monetary substance, paper money is merely a promise to pay real money at some time, some date in the future, subject to various contingencies and always uncertain. For that reason, a transfer of paper money between two persons does not and cannot transfer the underlying monetary asset immediately, only the promise to pay, that is, the liability of the maker of the promise. And it is much as, or inasmuch as, the promise may be more or less secured due to the creditworthiness of unworthiness of its maker, a transfer of paper money transfers not only a claim to the underlying real monetary asset, but also a risk of loss should the promise of payment, that is, the redemption, not be honored, either in whole or in part. Now, this is important because, remember, in 1933, Congress and the President took our gold away. Why did they do that? If you ever ask yourself, why? What difference did it make? If we had gold and paper in circulation, what difference did it make to you if you went down to Walmart and you bought a pair of shoes and you paid $5 in gold or $5 in paper? Did you care one way or the other? Well, as a matter of law, it's very important because when you pay with a piece of paper, you have not paid the debt, you have transferred the debt. A very important distinguishing characteristic. It's legal in nature. It doesn't make any difference to you as a matter of practical fact because you walk out of there with the item that you wanted to buy. You take it home, eat it, consume it, use it, and play with it, and do whatever you want. But as a property right, you've lost your right to property. And these politicians, when they took our gold away from us in 1933, knew full well that they had to do that to implement the first plank to the Communist Manifesto. You see, when you pay for something, when you and I make a trade, when you come to me and you say, Mr. Gordon, I want to buy that cow, and I'm going to give you 10 ounces of gold for that cow. You're actually paying the debt at law. You're buying the cow and paying for the cow. That gives you a property right or a property interest in that cow. When you write me a check for that cow, I'm giving you the property, and for practical purposes, you're walking out of here with the cow, and you're going to take her home and milk her, and you're going to drink the milk. But you don't own that cow, and neither do I. A third party has now moved in. The issuer of the note, that Federal Reserve promised to pay, has now moved in. And this is called a discharge in equity. By discharging your obligation, and by me accepting the discharge of the obligation, you and I transfer title to the cow to the Federal Reserve, and you have constructive ownership, that is, possessory title or ownership to the cow. But you don't own the cow, because you don't have title. The Federal Reserve does. Now, this is very important as a matter of law because to implement the first plank to the Communist Manifesto, which calls for the abolition of all right to property, in order for us to abolish your right to property without abolishing the Constitution, then we have to get you to voluntarily agree that you're going to undermine your property rights. And when you accept it, the Federal Reserve System, in lieu of specie money, by contract, you agreed that the Federal Reserve would represent you with their promises to pay. You declared yourself to be a fiscal irresponsible, unable to manage your financial affairs, and appointed the Federal Reserve to do that for you. You do that not by an implicit contract, that is, a signed document. You do that by an implied contract. The presumption is that you, the sovereign, you, the lawmaker, you, the sovereign power of America, know what you're doing when you contract, when you submit, when you agree to a fiduciary to represent you in your monetary interests. That's the bottom line. It's a legal issue. Everybody, whether they be Joe Sixpack driving a truck, Sally Housewife buying groceries, or Martha Stewart buying and selling stocks, when you're using commercial paper to make those transactions, those are not two-party transactions between you and me buying the cow. Those are three-party transactions between you and me buying and selling cows in the Federal Reserve. It's a three-party limited general partnership in which, as a matter of law, The Federal Reserve becomes the title holder, the owner, the title holder of the cow. You become the owner, that is, you become the holder in due course. We call you the owner, but you don't have title. As old William Bendix used to say, what a revolting development this has turned out to be. Now, people will sometimes call and ask, or they'll ask me here in class, Mr. Gordon, why do you price your schools in gold coin? Go to my webpage and I'll show you why. When you go to school here, we charge in gold coin. It's 4.5 ounces of gold or 9 ounces of gold. And it's a two-party transaction. It requires that you secure the gold through your labor, which is property, and then transfer that property to me. I, in turn, will transfer to you my property, my time, my labor, my materials, my books, my CDs. My property will be transferred to you upon your transfer of your property to me. That's a two-party transaction. It eliminates the Federal Reserve. It just takes the government and the Federal Reserve out of the transaction, and you and I don't have to keep any records of property transactions. That's protected under the Fourth Amendment to our Federal Constitution, our Bill of Rights, that protects our right to our persons, houses, property, and effects. Persons, houses, papers, and effects are property. It's a property protection. It's protected by thou shalt not steal. You shall not have an unjust weight or balance in your bag. God knew and understood. Our founding fathers knew and understood. We have to have gold and silver coin to have property and property rights. And our government, our Congress, our socialist guardians knew and understood that they had to take our gold and silver away from us to destroy our right to property so that they could control us. It's no big mystery. It's as simple as 1, 2, 3. It's a matter of law. And by keeping Americans legally incapacitated, that is, by not teaching you law in your universities and your public schools, we keep you virtually handcuffed, locked away, unable to change your status, unable to change your economic circumstances, unable to correct your guardian ward relationship with your government. And you can't change your guardian ward relationship with your government until you recover your capacity. And you can never recover your capacity without property and property rights. Once you've checked yourself into a mental hospital, you cannot release yourself. Only your guardian can release you. Now, if you check in under contract, like joining the army, the contract expires at some point in the future. Well, you've been listening to, and you are listening to, the Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. You know, we Americans talk a lot about private business. We use terms. We use terms like private ownership, private property, private rights. But we also use terms like stocks, bonds, negotiable instruments, licenses, and permits in our pursuit of profit and gain in our business transactions. Well, did you know that stocks and negotiable instruments are the exact opposite to private ownership? Bonds are the exact opposite to private property. Public business licenses are the exact opposite to private rights. Permits are the exact opposite to private business. Bonds, licenses, and permits are the substance of socialism, communism, and a guardian ward relationship, not private rights, private property, independence, and freedom. And why is it that we see small business being subjected to such a constant barrage of attacks by government at every level from Washington to your hometown? And what can you do to protect your life, your liberty, and your property from these incessant attacks by OSHA, the EPA, the State Tax Commission, Zoning and Planning, the IRS, and these swarms of government agents and agencies who are eating out your substance? Well, there's a lot you can do, and the first step is to inform yourself as to the legal alternatives between public business and private. Public business is done by permit, license, permission, regulation, and control. Private business is done with property, private property, gold and silver, among and between people with capacity, rights. Now, if you'd like to learn more about private business and rights, why don't you call and order my free general law CD package and let me tell you more about what it is that you're not supposed to know about private business. It's educational, it's entertaining, it's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge, and you can call and order yours right now. The number is 417-273-4967. That's area code 417-273-4967. If you're online, go to the website, georgegordon.org. Click onto the email and send me an email request for your free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. All right, let me give you that name and address again of Edwin Vieira, pieces of eight, and then I'm going to close out and show you what the statutes call for. Title 31, Section 50-101 is where it starts. Title 31, it's called our monetary system. So Chapter 1, monetary system. We'll cover the statutes here in a second, but the Sound Dollar Committee is where you want to write to get a copy of Pieces of Eight, P.O. Box 226, Fort Lee, New Jersey, 07024. That's Fort Lee, New Jersey, the zip code 07024, P.O. Box 226. The guy that wrote it, Edwin Vieira, his name is kind of odd. It's V-I-E-I-R-A. Three vowels in a row. V-I-E-I-R-A. Edwin Vieira. All right, now I mentioned to you last time, I'd take you through here and I'd show you what the numismatic coins are and how they work. Well, it's in Title 31. You can read this for yourself. Section 5101. United States money is expressed in dollars, dimes, or tenths, cents, or hundredths, and mills, or thousandths. A dime is a tenth of a dollar. A cent is a hundredth of a dollar. And a mill is a one-thousandth of a dollar. 5103, legal tender. United States coins and currency, including Federal Reserve notes and circulating notes of Federal Reserve banks and national banks, are legal tender for all debts, public charges, taxes, and dues, and foreign gold or silver coins are not legal tender for debts. All right, so if you have a Kruger Rand, that's not legal tender for debts. But if you have a $50 gold piece, a $25, $10, or a $5 gold piece, or a new silver dollar, or any of the old circulated silver coins, or the old circulated gold coins, they're legal tender for all debts, public and private. And there's a value for all of these coins. They're called numismatic coins, and there's a value for each and every one of them established in the marketplace, in the free market, every day. Now over here in section 5111, Title 31, section 5111, denominations, specifications, and designs of the coins. It says the Secretary of the Treasury may mint and issue only the following coins. A $50 gold coin that is 32.7 millimeters in diameter, weighs 33.931 grams, and contains 1 troy ounce of fine gold. A $25 gold coin that is 27 millimeters in diameter, weighs 16.966 grams, and contains 1/2 troy ounce of fine gold. A $10 gold coin that is 22 millimeters in diameter, weighs 8.483 grams, and contains 1/4 troy ounce of fine gold. And a $5 gold coin that is 16.5 millimeters in diameter, and weighs 3.392 grams, and contains 1/10 troy ounce of fine gold. There's our four gold coins back, $5, $10, $25, and $50. And each coin is marked plainly on the face of the coin, $5, $10, $25, and $50. They're legal tender coins, and Congress said so. Now they have the same value. Remember, they don't have the same weights and specifications with a $50 bill, but a $50 bill and a $50 gold piece has exactly the same value. They're $50. Now when you go to buy one of these $50 gold coins, you'll have to pay 400 of these Federal Reserve notes to secure one of these gold coins. Isn't that just real special? So now you can't go back to Article 1, Section 10 and say that the states aren't following Article 1, Section 10, because we now have our gold coin back in our grubby little hands so that we can buy, sell, and trade with it. Now why don't we learn how to buy, sell, and trade with our gold coins? And they're silver dollars also. In 31 U.S.C. 5111, or excuse me, I'm on 5112 here, 5112, E. Notwithstanding any other provisions of law, the Secretary shall mint and issue in quantity sufficient to meet public demand. Whatever the public demand is, there's plenty out there. Coins which are 40.6 millimeters in diameter and weigh 31.103 grams, contain 3/9 fine silver, have a design symbolic of liberty on the obverse side and an eagle on the reverse side, have inscriptions on them. United States of America, 1 ounce fine silver, e pluribus unum, and $1. So we have our $1 silver dollars back again. Since 1986, by the way. And they're minted, they mint just as many as the public requires. And there's, since only 5% of us use it, then the mint produces just enough for all of those of us that use gold and silver coin. Now let me share with you a little story here. I was over at the feed store some time back, and I went in and I said, "Hey, Mackie," I said, Would you sell me some alfalfa pellets? And he said, yeah, we'll do that. And I said, well, I put a $50 bill on the counter, and I said, well, how many alfalfa pellets can I get with it? And he said, well, you can get $10 a hundred, you can get 500 pounds. So I said, well, Mackie, let me ask you this question. I put a $50 gold piece on the counter, and I said, how many alfalfa pellets can I get with this? And he looked at it, and he'd never seen one before, and he said, well, what is this? And I said, that's a $50 gold piece. And he looked at it, and he had put his glasses on, and he read it, and he said, well, I've never seen one of these before. I said, how much is this worth? And I said, $50. And he said, well, you can get 500 pounds with it. And I said, but Mackie, don't you think that a gold coin is worth more than a $50 piece of paper that costs 3 cents to print? And he said, well, you know, you'd think it oughta, wouldn't you? And I said, you know, if you took that into Charlie, the gold broker, and put that on the counter, he would give you 8 $50 bills for that. And he said, well, why is it only worth $50 then? And I said, because Congress declared it. Congress, you see, at Article 1, Section 8, has the power to coin money and regulate the value thereof. So when you go to pay your taxes, your fines, and your dues, that $50 gold coin is worth no more and no less than a $50 bill. And he said, well, that's not a strange. And he said, well, who would want to deal in these gold coins then? And I said, well, everyone that wants to obey God and keep his commandments. For instance, thou shalt not steal in Exodus 20, and you shall not have an unjust weight or balance in your bag in Leviticus 19, 35 and 36. And Mackey said, well, that's kind of dumb. Who'd want to do that? And I said, well, I guess you'd have to be a religious fanatic, wouldn't you? He said, boy, I'll tell you, you'd have to be a fanatic. To pay $400 for a gold coin and then sell it, or to trade it, or to spend it, and only get $50 worth of goods, and lose $350 in the process, boy, that'd really be dumb. I said, well, you know, there's another side to this, Mackey. And then he said, well, what's that? And I said, well, those of us that deal in these gold coins have a little bit of an advantage, you know, over the average guy on the street. For instance, there's no reporting requirements on these. So when I deal in $10,000, $20,000, $50,000 worth of these, you know, I don't have to report them. Gold brokers do, banks do, institutions do, corporations do. They've got licenses and permits, but, you know, I don't have to do that because this is property, and I've got a property right here. I said, that's one advantage. But I said, you know, there's another advantage to this. And I pointed this out to him. I said, you know, Congress has said this is legal tender for all debts, public and private. It says so right here on this $50 bill. Look at this. Congress in Title 31 says that this is a legal tender coin. Let me show you something here. Let's suppose, just follow this through with me, Mackie, and I'll show you how to make a little extra profit here. I said, ordinarily, you write a check, don't you, to Tyndall, and then Tyndall sells you the feed. So you wrote a check last week for $5, and you bought 100 pounds of these alfalfa pellets, and you want to sell it to me this week for $10. Isn't that about right? And he said, yeah, that's about the way that works. And then you're going to make a $5 profit, and off of that $5 profit, you got to pay your expenses, you know, the light and heat and gas, and then you got to pay your taxes and things like that. And when you get all through, if you were to make a dollar or two off of that, you'd be pretty happy, wouldn't you? He said, yeah, look. I said, now, why don't you run through this drill with me? I want you to give me, instead of giving me 500 pounds of these alfalfa pellets for a $50 Federal Reserve note, I want you to give me 4,000 pounds of alfalfa pellets for one $50 gold piece. And he said, okay, how's that going to benefit me? I said, okay, let's run this drill through and let's see how this works. Last week, you wrote a check, did you not, to the Tyndall Company to buy those 4,000 pounds. That's 4,000 or $200, did you not? He said, yeah, I wrote him a check for $200, and there's the 80 sacks, 50-pound sacks, sitting right over there. 4,000 weight. I said, okay. So that's called cost of goods sold, isn't it? He said, yeah, it is. It is. $200. I said, good. Now, I want you to sell that pile to me right now. Write out a bill of sale to me. Write out a receipt here. 4,000 pounds of alfalfa pellets for $50. And just write on there $50 in gold coin if you would so prefer. You don't have to, but if you'd like to, write it out. So he wrote a receipt to me for $50, wrote bill of sale on there, and he sold me the 4,000 pounds for $50. And I said, now how much profit did you make on this transaction? And he said, well, let's see. In the last week, I wrote a check for $150 to Tyndall, and I bought the feed, and I brought it into my store. And today I sold it to you for $50, and I lost $150 on the transaction. I said, yeah, that's right. I said, now, how much tax do you owe on that $150 loss? And he said, well, gee, I don't owe any tax. And I said, that's because it's not against the law to be a bad businessman. And every once in a while, you'll see a lost leader like this put out. Businessmen do that, draw customers in. And boy, you sure drew me in here, Mackie. And he said, well, boy, I can see that. Now, now, what am I going to do with this $50 gold coin? I said, well, you ring that into the cash register. So he rang a $50 sale into the cash register, and he put the $50 bill underneath the cash drawer. I guess he wanted to keep it separate. And he closed the cash register, and I said, okay, now the transaction's complete, and your paper trail or your records are complete, are they not? So that your accountant can figure your taxes and do your expenses, and yeah, everything's fine. So, okay. Now that $50 gold coin is actually worth more than $50 out here in the marketplace, I mean, in the free market world. As a matter of money, it's only worth $50. Congress said so, but there are people out here that value those gold coins actually much higher. In paper money, they value them higher than $50. So if you got a $50 bill in your wallet, and he said he did, I said, well, ring up a no sale then and put $50 into the cash register, and you take out that $50 gold coin, just like you would if you got an unusual coin and change. You'd exchange that coin for some money that you've got in your pocket now, wouldn't you? You know, if somebody brought in an unusual quarter or dime or 50-cent piece or something, he said, yeah. I said, now is that a pretty normal transaction for you? He said, yeah, I can see that. Okay, now that $50 gold piece is now your $50 gold piece, isn't it? Yeah, and now you take that into Springfield to Charlie, the gold broker, and you put it on the counter, and I think he's going to give you in the neighborhood of $8 $50 bills for that. Now, I said to Mackie, I said, now, so far you don't have a taxable transaction, but you're going to get one here. So I showed him my little Mead memo book. It fits right in my shirt pocket, and I said, now, when you put that $50 gold coin on the counter, see, it's only worth $50 face value, but you're going to get a huge profit. You're going to get 400 Federal Reserve notes, $8 bills for that. In other words, when you put your $50 bill in and you bought that valuable numismatic coin, numismatic because Congress said in Title 31 that it's numismatic, then you sold it to Charlie and you made a profit of $350, didn't you? And he said, yeah, I see that. I said, okay. Now, with that $350 profit, you need to write that in your MEED memo book and keep track of it because it's a cash transaction, because Charlie is going to put eight $50 bills out here on the counter. One of them replaces the one that was your original capital when you bought this numismatic coin, but the other seven are profit, and you have to pay a capital gain tax on whatever that capital gain tax is on that $350. So you write that down and you keep track of each and every one of these transactions throughout the year, because, you know, when you get to be old like us, Mackie, you get kind of senile and Alzheimer's and you can't remember like you used to when you were a kid, and you'll forget, and you don't want to cheat the government out of their tax. And the tax isn't on the gold coin. The tax is on the profit that you made off of the gold coin. The tax is on the paper money. The tax is the penalty that you pay for dealing in unjust weights and balances in violation of thou shalt not steal, and you shall not have an unjust weight or balance in your bag. That's what you're paying the tax on, boys and girls. The income tax is the penalty that you pay for using paper money. Now, God told you not to use it, and you said, well, God, you made a mistake, and we're going to use it. Well, you got to pay a penalty for it. It's called income tax. And I want to make sure that when you trade this gold coin now, and you get eight of these Federal Reserve note $50 bills, that you pay your partner, the United States of America and the Federal Reserve Bank, their commission, their share of this joint partnership that you have with your government. I mean, most of you people listening to me right now are solid, good Republicans and Democrats, loyal Americans, taxpayers, and you support your God, the United States of America. Now, let's make sure we don't cheat the United States of America out of their tax money. And that's why you keep the little MEED memo book, so you can write down these transactions, because if you don't, and you don't write down each and every one of these transactions, you may forget one, or two, or five. And remember, if you got a $350 profit, and the capital gain tax is 28%, that's 350, times 0.28, that's a $98 tax that you owe to the government. And you need to pay the government that $98 tax on the 350, because that's the profit that you make. Remember? I've heard of people that didn't keep track of those and didn't write them down and then forgot and didn't pay the government and cheated them out of their money. I don't want you to do that. Now, you see how that works? Now, listen, Congress says that there's no difference in the value of a $50 gold piece and a $50 bill. Now, Congress wouldn't lie to you, would they? I mean, Congress is God. Congress is the sovereign power. Congress is the lawmaker. I didn't write this law, so don't get mad at me. I think $50 bills and $50 gold pieces should be equal in value. And I think Congress should have declared their value. I think that a $50 gold piece should, with its inflated value, be valued at $400, not at $50. But then, you know, I don't make these laws. I don't make these rules. I'm just telling you this is the way the game is played. Now, a guy by the name of Franklin Sanders wrote a real neat article. It's called What is a Numismatic Coin and Why You Should Not Buy Them? Franklin Sanders is not in the business of buying numismatic coins, and I don't recommend them either. Numismatic coins, that's those coins, you know, like MS-60s. MS-65, you know, you buy a $20 St. Gaudens gold piece and pay $10,000 Federal Reserve note dollars for it. It has about a 25% premium on it, so I think I would avoid those if I were you. I do. I avoid numismatic coins like AIDS, herpes, and VD. There's no money in those. The money, though, is in buying, selling, and trading in property and using gold and silver coin and obeying God and keeping His commandments. I told you early on that there is a real benefit for dealing in gold and silver coin. Gold and silver coin. I find that when people come here and they want to buy something, I'm going to tell you about a quick transaction. A neighbor of mine had a piece of ground over here and he wanted to sell it. And he said to me he wanted $50,000. I said, that's a lot of money, Everett. And I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll give you $6,400 in gold coin. And Everett was shocked. $6,400. He said, I paid $26,000 for that piece of property. And I want to sell it for $50,000. And I said, Everett, why don't I give you $6,400? You give me a bill of sale. Then, if you want to take the $6,400 and convert that to a cashier's check, and Everett said that's what he wanted. He said, my God, I got to have real money, George. He wanted real money printed by the Federal Reserve that says United States of America. And I said, okay, Everett, if you don't want one of these old clunky gold coins, you know, that's fine with me. But I won't pay you $50,000 for that, but I will pay you $6,400 in gold coin. Then if you'll give me your Social Security number, I think we could take this in, put it on the counter, and convert that into a $50,000 cashier's check. And Everett said, that's what I want to do. He said, I paid $26,000 for that property and I don't want to sell it for $6,400 because I wouldn't have a profit. But I want to sell it for $50,000 because I paid $26,000 and I only have a $24,000 profit. Now, Everett had a $24,000 profit because he got a cashier's check for $50,000 deposited over here in the Bank of Gainesville. It's called Century Bank now. Now, that $24,000 times 0.28 means that he wrote a check for $6,720 and paid his income tax or capital gain tax on the profit that he made on that land transaction. Meanwhile, I got a piece of property over here for $6,400. And the property tax on that is predicated upon a $26,000 piece of property. And I think that I got a $6,400 piece of property. I don't think I've got a $26,000 piece of property. And I think this year I'm going to go in and talk to the county commissioners about lowering the taxes on that property because it has not appreciated in value. It has depreciated in value. And I've got the documents to prove it. Well, that's another story for another day, boys and girls, and we'll talk about that story in the future. Meanwhile, let me remind you again, Pieces of Eight, remember, Pieces of Eight, a book written by Edwin Vieira. I think that it'll be well worth your $20. I think that's about what it's going to cost you, about $20. It's in paperback. Published by the Sound Dollar Committee, Post Office Box 226, Fort Lee, New Jersey, 07024. Again, that's Sound Dollar Committee. Post Office Box 226, Fort Lee, New Jersey, 07024. It'll probably be about $20, and it's written by Edwin Vieira. That's spelled V-I-E-I-R-A. Three vowels in a row. Very unusual name, Edwin Vieira. And it'll tell you the story about gold and paper money and the history of it here in the United States of America. All right, I'm about out of time. That's enough for this week. You've been listening to The Law Hour, and the editorial review was sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week on Truth Radio Network and worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the Gordon Law School and The Law Hour, please go to my website at georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. And the Gordon Law School is a private, nonprofit, non-commercial, non-sectarian law school. And the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to the website, the homeschooling page, georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. Well, there's the signal that says our time is up, so we're going to have to leave it right there. I'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, 7 days a week, God willing. So until then, goodbye, friends.